Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Can technology save us? Even if you don't count the financial collapse, the crises we have to deal with are severe at best. Peak oil is here, which means that gasoline and oil are going to get more and more expensive and harder to obtain in quantity. That's not entirely bad, because scientists say we've got to radically reduce the amount we burn, lest we touch off even more catastrophic changes in the Earth's environment than we have already. The transition to a viable civilization will not be easy, assuming our capitalist owners allow any changes at all. I believe they think that record profits for three consecutive quarters would be well worth 800 million people drowning 2 years down the road. Some reassure us that technology will save us without requiring any large changes. The U.S. Department of Energy has a nifty video documentary explaining how hydrogen-powered cars and trucks are the answer. So 20 years from now, trucks will still be hauling carrots 3,000 miles from field to Walmart's grocery bins. Can technology save us? Today, two fine and very funny speakers say, forget it. Jellaby Offer says, remember the last technology that was supposed to transform the world profoundly and for the better. That was the personal computer and the internet. Sure, much good they've done, but they've also created as much social alienation, human bondage, and destruction of real community as have our strip malls and McMansionville estates. Then James Howard Kunstler, reporter and scholar of the human environment, discusses why energy sources are one thing, technology is something else, and only the seriously deluded, like the rich young genius dudes of Silicon Valley, only they imagine that more of one can compensate for too little of the other. Let's start with Jell-O speaking. Just this past July, to an audience of high-tech Silicon Valley types, who indeed seem to get what Jell-O is saying.
I mean, in the blogs, the best part is anyone can do it and anything goes. And the worst part is anyone can do it and anything goes. And some people poison it for everybody else by being a lot looser with the truth than CNN and Fox combined. Of course, now there are bloggers paid by corporations to look like your average citizen, enthusiastic for the corporation. According to Wired, the military is now thinking of hiring their own blogging brigade to promote their spin and message on things, or trash a specific critic they want to neutralize. But this got me thinking. We are rapidly approaching an age where everybody, because of this and YouTube and whatnot, is going to be under their own R-Town version of Britney Spears Klieg lights, and our own personal reputations trashed on YouTubes and poison pen nasty blogs before anybody is even old enough to drink. Thus leaving people with no one to be inspired or influenced by, because look at them, everybody sucks. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? At least it levels the playing field. At the same time, this risks people being desensitized to really bad behavior by genuine assholes because look at them. Everybody's an asshole, anybody. Can't trust anyone. No trust, no respect, no admiration, no inspiration. I mean, in a way, the explosion of virtual communities on the internet shows how isolated and lonely we are in our self-imposed virtual cocoons. It shows a deep, desperate hunger to, as the phone company said, reach out and touch someone and have some meaningful connection to others without leaving your desk or cubicle, I guess. Three sociologists who worked at the University of Arizona and Duke University did a 20-year study from 1985 to 2004 that showed a sharp decline in the number of people the average American discussed anything meaningful with. Fewer close relationships with coworkers, neighbors, even family, even friends. I mean, if the World Wide Web is bringing everybody together, how come we're getting more and more disconnected? I fear that MySpacing out and Facebooking your face and all that is leading to a generation. I don't think middle school people, especially, and people younger, should feel this intense peer pressure that they have to advertise, package, and market themselves as a product on the internet just to validate their existence as a human being in order to make friends. Zippy the Pinhead had a great one on this, too. My Facebook page is up and running, and I'm already friending every dry cleaner in a tri-state area. Yow! I'm getting attacked now! Why did I wait so long to open myself up to abuse like this? I feel validated, humiliated, and 13 all over again. A lawyer from Google had this to say to the New York Times a while back. Young people don't care about privacy the way they once did, especially if they're being told that this is the way you consume and everybody's got to put up, hey, look at me, look at me, look at me. And only now are some of them finding out when they get a little older that a snotty teenage comment you made on Facebook can cost you a job as an adult or get you thrown out of college. Prospective employers now mine MySpace and Facebook and the other things like it, looking for dirt and looking for people not to hire. Never mind who might be best for the job. Let's see how they screwed up and disqualify them that way. In a weird way, though, I do look forward to the day when something like this happens to some family values politician or right-wing Supreme Court nominee, and suddenly they go down in flames like the Hindenburg when somebody finds out about all the animals they bragged they had sex with while drunk on their Facebook page as a teenager. On the other hand, does this mean if we're going to participate in this network that we all have to be as paranoid about our every single thing we do from childhood, or, you know, just like some egomaniac who's planning to run for president in 30 years, we all have to be that careful and walk on eggshells, even in our own bedrooms, imprison ourselves in a constant state of, I tried, but I didn't inhale? I mean, that being washed like that, having to worry about that, is even crueler than the Catholic Church. And with no chance to confess and magically make everything all better. I mean, that is hardly my idea of expanding democracy. And Google, among others, has made it their business to collect and store and sell more information about you and everything you've bought and everything you read than the FBI, the CIA, and the Keystone Stormtroopers at Homeland Security combined. And Facebook, as many of you know, launched their beacon service last year, notifying users' friends of a person's online purchases without their permission, thus exposing in advance who's what you're going to get for Christmas from those people. But what if you look up, oh, this friend who you've been going out with who's on your Facebook page just bought a pregnancy test and you've been out of town for a month. Yeah, and you thought Obama voting to let the NSA spy on us was your worst problem. This is how we volunteer to be violated by these people. Anna Lee, I hope I say your last name right, Navitz? Anyway, who until recently wrote for the San Francisco Bay Guardian and was the best thing in the paper, she had an interesting comment about this. The more public our friend lists are, the more we feel like we have to pick our friends based on public opinion. That's not expanding democracy. That's high school. Facebook and MySpace and the others are all good tools, of course, to expand what you know and who you know. But if that's all people want to know, again, they're dumbing themselves down, and we can't let that happen. We can't be in the information age and allow people to know less and less and less. Is this much screen suckling making people smarter, or is it making people dumber? And I will use some of the same examples I used last time, because if anything, this has gotten worse. Oh, did you talk to that person? Yeah, I talked to him. Well, what did they say? Well, I didn't talk to him. I just emailed them. That's not talking to somebody. sending an email, not waiting for a reply, and assuming your job is done, wrong. Communication is an equation. You got to get the other half of the communication or you have not communicated. And just, you know, sitting there day after day, didn't you get my email? Didn't you get my email? I mean, if you're that desperate, call them on the phone. And in the age of instant messaging, it's amazing how this works. You ask somebody something on the phone, they answer you instantly. And you know what you can do instantly after that is to ask them another question. And they answer it, and even ask them another question, and you've saved yourself weeks of snitty emails to get more stuff done. An ex-girlfriend of mine in L.A. said she was out at a club seeing a band a while back, and a woman came up to her, chatted her up. They hit it off really well. She tells the other woman her name. Oh, you're my MySpace friend. And then the other woman walked away. It's like, oh, I just didn't want to actually talk to you or find out you were real. I just wanted your picture in my gallery of virtual friends where I feel more comfortable. And oh, these are my special friends because they never talk back to me. I love my friend collection, my trophy room. Used to be that living in a world of imaginary friends was considered a mental illness. Text. I'm 20 yards away from you at the mall, but I'm not going to talk to you. I mean, the California teenagers went on the news and were outraged when the law went through that you couldn't be yapping on your phone while holding your phone to your ear while you're driving, saying, that's not going to stop me. I know my rights. If somebody texts me, I'm going to text them back right then and there, even if I'm driving through a major intersection in mom's SUV. Wham! And, you know, it's interesting, though, the language, the texting is, you know, when you get kind of tired of it after a while but won't admit it, you keep shortening words and shortening words, new abbreviations and new language and all. Maybe it'll be like Chinese and Japanese and Korean characters. Who knows eventually? But some of these abbreviations, I mean, it feeds this impulse in Americans to abbreviate their brains and abbreviate the amount of time they think, too. Carbohydrates. Very few people knew or cared what that was. But as soon as it was shortened to carbs, everyone was deathly afraid of them for about 2 years. Now, short attention span America has been treated to Washington Mutual, the bank, shortening their name to WAMU to be better understood by short attention span people. I mean, and if we keep getting MySpaced out, text, instant this, instant that, we're kind of missing everything else and are that much easier to manipulate. And what are we creating here when the cyber world and instant blipping and blooping is more real than reality? What happens when these people are in charge? An example of what happens when someone is so completely disengaged, they live in a virtual world all their own, who just bounces from one childish impulse to another. Granted, the origins are different. Perfect example of this is when you hand somebody like that something really important. Look no further than the red, white, and blue Caligula himself, George W. Bush.
The problem with the French is they don't have a word for entrepreneur.
Some of these are new quotes, too. They stopped playing.
Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
Edison, mixing up the medicine, messing up time from Accrington to Amazon. See them all come with their wires and boots and their itchy little bums saying, play a funky drum.
Jump in the dark.
machine became the star, beat to the bar. Poor Gus Dudgeon lying in his car, down in the basement, messing with the moment. Alchemy and element, smashing up your instrument. Old Thomas Edison, mixing up the medicine, messing up time from Accrington to Amazon. See them all come with their wires and booms, and their itchy little thumbs saying, play a funky drum. Sorting out the copyright takes a little time, but the contract's airtight. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? The money's in the black, but the needle's in the red. Old Thomas Edison, mixing up the medicine, messing up time from Accrington to Amazon. See them all come with their wires and booms, and their itchy little thumbs saying, play a funky drum.
That was Chumbawamba. This is New World Notes. And here comes Can Technology Save Us? Part 2. James Howard Kunstler is giving a slide presentation to an appreciative audience in upstate New York.
You know, there are some major obstacles to our ability to think coherently and to mount a public discussion about these issues that makes sense. And one of them is this. In this media-saturated culture, it's now become normal for adults in North America to think that when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. It's a nice thought for a six-year-old child, but it's not a good idea for most adults to believe this. You know, because among other things, you know, one of the hallmarks of being an adult is knowing the difference between wishing for stuff and making stuff happen. And a whole continent full of people who think that just wishing for stuff will make things happen are going to be very disappointed. It's accompanied by this other idea. Actually, this is America's newest and fastest growing religion, okay, which is not evangelical Christianity. It's the worship of unearned riches. And it's based on the theological idea that it's possible to get something for nothing. Now, that also is inconsistent with the way the universe works, but it's now become a normative belief throughout most of adult America. So you combine these two, what have become two normal ideas in America now, the idea that it's that when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true, and that when you wish upon a star, you'll get something for nothing. And that's where we're at with the alternative energy situation. We're all sitting around wishing to get something for nothing, and it's not going to happen. And I saw a really interesting example of this about a year and a half ago. I was invited to give a talk at the Google headquarters in Silicon Valley. And I went down there, their headquarters are in an office park building in some jive plastic suburb in near San Jose somewhere. And it was really interesting. The whole building was tricked out like a kindergarten, okay? They had knock hockey sets and foosball games and ping pong and video game consoles, and they had the Lucite boxes with the gummy bears and the yogurt-covered pretzels. And, you know, it was the perfect kindergarten. And this is the highest level of corporate enterprise now in America, you know? And so I thought, oh, that, it's nice. They're very playful. Isn't that cute? And then we went into the auditorium, which was a much larger space than this even, and the Google executives and senior engineers came in, okay? And they were dressed like skateboard rats. You know, they had, like, sideways hats on. You know, their pants were, their ass crack was showing because their pants were falling down. Like, dude. I've become addicted to that. Like, dude. And so, you know, I gave my spiel about energy, and at the time I was not talking about Google, right? Because, you know, I hadn't been there before, so I wasn't talking about it. And so I gave my spiel about energy, and, you know, we got a problem with energy, blah, 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 blah. And we did, like, comments and questions afterwards, and 17 guys got up afterwards, and there were no questions. They all made the same comment. And the comment was, like, dude, we've got technology. Subtext, you're an asshole. Case dismissed. But, you know, I soon realized what I was seeing, you know, was that I realized finally that, you know, all this juvenilia going on around me, I realized that, you know, these were the senior engineers and executives of Google. These were people who had become multi-millionaires, you know, at age 27. And they had accomplished it by moving pixels around a screen with a mouse. Okay, so that they had developed this grandiose delusion that all of the sorrows of mankind could be solved by pushing pixels around a screen with a mouse, you know? And the trouble with that is what it fundamentally meant was they really didn't know the difference between energy and technology. They thought that they were the same, you know, that you could substitute one for the other. If you run out of energy, dude, get some technology. Get an iPod. Listen to some tunes. And, you know, this is happening at the highest level of technological enterprise in America, okay? This wasn't the Acme Bowling Pin Company. This was the new economy. This was Silicon Valley. You know, this was the Brazilian dollar company. And so, you know, if they don't get it, you know, what if they don't get it at the highest level of American technology, who's going to get it? So the delusional thinking is just amazing, you know? Okay. Go get 100,000 iPods, grind them up, and put them in there. And then we'll take off, okay? So we're going to run these things. Either we're going to run these things on the stuff they're used to running on, namely liquid hydrocarbon, you know, kerosene-like aviation fuel, or we're not going to have an aviation industry of the kind that we've been used to. And the prospect is that we're not. You know, we're not. And we can already see that's another one of those complex systems out there that's wobbling, and that is like looking like it's sooner or later is going to fail. And we're not going to change out the hardware. We're either going to run the Boeing 707s and 37s and 57s and blah, 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 and the Airbuses, et cetera, or we're not going to, these companies aren't going to run. Certainly not going to run the way they're running. So technology is not energy. And this, of course, is, you know, this is basically the fundamental idea that's lurking in the delusional mind is that there's some, you know, there's some group of meta scientists out there who are going to magically deliver all these rescue remedies to us. And that is not helpful. These ideas and these delusional thoughts are really being expressed most clearly in the salient theme that has emerged from this in the popular debate. In other words, the only thing that we're really talking about all across North America is how we're going to run the cars by other means. And everybody's excited about it. People come up to me after a talk and they say, dude, I got a Prius. You know? And they don't get it. It's not about, you know, the fact that the cars we're running are too big and too powerful. It's about the fact that we're running too many cars incessantly. Okay? Of all kinds. I don't care whether it's a Prius or a Cadillac Escalando. or a Plymouth Invicta, Inflicta. It doesn't really matter. But the important point is that we have to change this subject. And when you go to your cocktail parties, when you go to your dinner parties, meet with your friends, talk casually about the energy problem, if it comes up next time there's a gas hike or anything like that, you know, we got to start changing the subject and not just talk about how we're going to run the cars by biodiesel or use French fried potato oil. We got to start talking about making other arrangements for all of these complex systems that we depend on, not just the motoring. And these two can be, you know, we can form a comprehensive to-do list about all these things, that all these tasks that we face. Very clear, you know, at the upper right there, we're going to have to do agriculture different. We have no idea how we're going to do this differently, but we're probably going to have to do it in smaller units, smaller farms, and it will probably require some amount more of human attention than is getting now, because we're going to be able to run fewer machines. You know, I don't know whether it's no machinery at all or 90% of the machinery we're running now. We really don't know, but it's going to change. We got to do it differently.
Thanks for listening. New World Notes is produced for WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. The Jello Biafra section is from a long recording provided by Hunch and Toot. The James Howard Kunstler excerpt is from installment number 397 of Unwelcome Guests. Many thanks to the Unwelcome Guests Collective and producer Lynn Gurry. New World Notes is available off the air by internet stream, podcast, or MP3 download at your convenience. There's an archive of past shows, a weekly newsletter, and a blog. All is free. For more information, start at the blog. We're at http://newworldnotes.blogspot.com. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. To comment or to receive the newsletter, email a note to Kay Doust. That's kdoust@hotmail.com. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the views of the station management, staff, Leo the janitor, or our gracious host and licensee, and they are protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. From Darkest New England, this is Kenneth Doust, wishing you a good week and advising illegitimi non carborundum, keep the faith, bicycle when you can, and please tune in again.